and welcome to episode 137 of Tea or Books. I'm Rachel.
I'm Simon.
And today we are going to be starting the episode with resolved or unresolved endings. Which do we prefer? Which has been suggested to us by Lindsay. Thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay.
We really appreciate people giving us topics. And then in the second half, we are going to be comparing two books that we recommended to each other from our top 10 books of last year, which are Perfection by Vincenzo Latronico, which has been translated from Italian into English by Sophie Hughes, and Pamela Hansford-Johnson's Catherine Carter. So, first of all, Simon, how are you? What are you reading?
Yeah, I will just start by correcting you early on. These were not from our top 10 last year. We've already done that episode. That was in the past. These were books we just thought the other one would like. So.
Oh, right, confusing. Because... Yeah. Did I? Well, okay, fine.
We did Enter Ghost and Lady Living Alone for our top 10 last year.
Oh, right. So this is my memory. To be that, in my defence, mm-hmm. we had the Ofsted inspectors in last week, so it's been a bit intense.
But, you know, I always relish the opportunity to correct you, so everyone's a winner. Yes, I was saying just before we started recording, loving that it's light in the evenings. I love spring. I do get quite bad hay fever, so that's, you know, not the best thing about spring, but I love everything else about spring, and in fact gives me a great opportunity to say that the latest British Library Women Writers book, The Spring Begins by Catherine Dunning, is, well, it's not quite out as we record, but it might well be by the time I hit publish, and that was my favorite book of last year, so I'm very excited that that is back in bookshops. But the book I've been reading recently that I was going to mention is, well, I read an edition called Some Must Watch by Ethelina White, but it's been reprinted as The Spiral Staircase recently by Pushkin Press. Have you read any Ethelina White?
I've read the one that is The Lady Vanishes.
Yes, The Wheel Turns. Yes, that's, I can never remember if it's Turns or Spins, whichever one it is. Yes, that's the only one I'd read previously. And so, but then I read Some Must Watch, which was turned into a film called The Spiral Staircase, which is why they've used that title for the reprint. I've not seen the film, although it is a classic, apparently, of the genre. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. It basically takes place over 2 days, one quite truncated day, and then most of the novel is this long evening into night, of this lady Helen, let's say she's called Helen, who has gone to stay with this family in the middle of nowhere in the Welsh English borders. And their eccentric intergenerational family, and she starts by walking towards the house. You've first seen this thing as she's going approaching it, and is very fearful because there is a serial killer on the loose who has been killing young women in the area. She safely gets home that day, but then all the next day, as a storm rages outside, they're waiting to see, or she's waiting to see whether or not a serial killer will try and get into the house. And it's sounds quite schlocky as a premise, and, you know, that's the sort of thing that was in, you know, penny magazines and all that sort of thing at the time, but it's done really well. She's a great writer, I thought, and the tension just ramps up and up and up, and it's done because it's well written and there's good descriptions and interesting characters, and it's not just a shock horror, you know, doors banged and gives you a jump sort of thing. There is that sort of thing in there as well, but it's done more, it's more psychologically nuance than that, I guess. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was not too scary for me. It was like 1930s scary, so doable. And yeah, it's a British Library crime classics, and Pushkin are both reprinting her at the moment, so she's been very hard to get hold of except for The Wheel Spins, and it's nice that more of them will be available, or are becoming available now.
Yes, well, I should very much look forward to reading some more of hers. I've just had a look, and I can see that the British Library Crime Classics have got a couple. Well, when your new book comes out, I should pop down to the British Library and go to the bookshop and pick myself up that and a couple of Ethelina White's.
Hurrah! Yeah. Lovely stuff. What are you reading?
Well, I've not been reading very much, to be honest, because I've been so busy with work. But I've obviously been reading. I just want to point this out that when Simon and I recommended to each other, I gave Simon a novella that's like barely 100 pages, and I got a book that's 450 pages long. So,
yeah, no, you're right. It was unkind of me. Yes.
Yes, it was. But you know what? It's fine.
I fully anticipated you messaging me asking for another week. So I'm very impressed that we're recording at all.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's been lucky for you. I've had a couple of long train journeys over the last otherwise we would have been in trouble. But I'm about to start reading, and I'm very excited, rereading, I should say, Persuasion by Jane Austen, because I'm going to be teaching it to my class. And I took them to Jane Austen's house on Friday on a trip.
Oh, wow.
And the most wonderful time. And they made me dress up as well. We all dressed up and had a wonderful time with our bonnets and our dresses on. And it was lovely. And it really reminded me how much I love her. And I've not read anything by her in ages. So I'm going to read Persuasion first because I'm teaching it. Obviously, I need to get ahead of the game. But I'm also planning on then trying to get my way through the others so that I can be refreshed. Because it's been a while since I've read one. And when do we give ourselves time to reread, you know?
Exactly. Not that often. Although I've just been actually maybe I already mentioned that last episode, because I've actually been re-listening to lots of Virginia Woolf novels. Well, three. And that's been lovely. So my Audible subscription is ending, so I'm using their free Virginia Woolf collection at the moment. Mrs. Dalloway, which is wonderful, To the Lighthouse, and now The Waves.
Wonderful. Do you know what? I've never actually made it through The Waves.
Yeah, I think I've already said in here before, it's not the sort of book you can read with any sort of hope of knowing what's going on. It's just enjoying how beautiful the language is.
Over you, don't you?
Yeah, literally. And I actually... the Mrs. Dalloway read by Kristin Scott Thomas was the best audiobook experience I ever had. I'm not sure Jessie Buckley was quite the right voice for To the Lighthouse, but it was still lovely.
Jessie Buckley does To the Lighthouse.
She does indeed, yeah.
Intriguing.
And then The Waves is all-star cast. Every voice is someone different.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So I don't think I'm going to finish that in the next 2 days that I have, but I thought I can get as far as I can get, and then I'll read the rest in print.
Yeah. That's nice. Yeah, I need to read some more. Okay, so shall we have a think about endings? Because this is a topic that we've probably sort of skirted around when we talked about other things. But
yeah, and we've done happy versus sad endings, certainly. Yeah. But we will endeavour not to give too many spoilers.
No, it's a difficult one to talk about, actually, isn't it? Endings without... I suppose, just not being explicit. So can you think of an example of a book where you felt that the ending was unresolved and you weren't happy with it?
Ooh, because I had a little think, and I was thinking about ones I was happy with. And let me think. I guess the ones I'm unhappy with are when it's a genre that really seems to call for resolution and then you don't get one. And I was trying to think, what are the books that really call for resolution? It's The Marriage Plot and it's The Detective Novel are the two I came up with. And I'm sure there are others. But those are ones where the whole point of it really is getting to the end. Obviously, there's more going on than that. But particularly in The Detective Novel, the resolution is what you want. And so... have I read any detective novels which didn't tell me who did it? I've read some where I didn't really understand what was going on at the end. Does that count? but I don't think I've read any that just gave up completely. Oh, actually, a good sort of parallel example is Memento Mori by Muriel Spark, which is about lots of people who are getting phone calls saying, "Remember, you must die." And it's a range of people, including lots of people I can't remember if it's a geriatric ward or an old people's home or something like that. So, people who probably are relatively near death, and they're all getting this phone call, and it's a bit of a mystery about who it is. And then being Muriel Spark, I won't give away the ending, but it's certainly not a sort of open and shut. It turned out it was this guy who was doing it. It's much weirder than that. But it's not a good example of not being satisfied, because I loved that it was mad. But if you read it thinking it was going to be like an Agatha Christie or indeed an Athelina White, where you're like, oh, we finally unearthed the culprit, unmasked the culprit, either. It's certainly not that sort of novel. But I will have a think if I can think of any more that have been disappointing me with lack of resolution. But do you have any that come to mind for that?
Well, I mean, that I was deeply disappointed by the end of Villette by Charlotte Bronte. And I remember reading it and got to the end and I just threw it across the room, because it kind of leaves the ending open. says it's up to you to decide sort of thing, what happens. And I was like, well, I don't want that. I want you to tell me what's happened. So now I don't have to live in this terrible situation where, you know, I don't know whether he's alive or not, you know. And I thought it was a bit of a cop out of an ending, which I do think it's it kind of, I mean, I think I know what she intended anyway. Mm. And it's sort of a device. But at the same time, I just thought, I have slogged through 500 pages for this. I need some certainty. And I think what you say about genre and thinking about a particular expectation you have when you're reading a certain genre, you know, Villette is a romance novel if we're going to give it a generic kind of badge to put on the spine. Some people might disagree with that, but I think ultimately the plot revolves around that, so why not? And so with a romance novel, you expect a nice bow on the end and for everybody to be skipping off into the sunset.
Yeah.
When you don't get that, regardless of whether it's resolved or not, I would still say it's an unresolved ending because it hasn't met the expectations of the genre.
That's a good point. Mm. Yes. And I mean, in some ways it feels unresolved if it's not the ending that you wanted. Like, I remember thinking, when I first read I Captured the Castle, when I was, I guess, 16, 17, I was quite disappointed with the ending of that because it wasn't, and again, that this is a spoiler, but it isn't she ends up with this guy or she ends up with that guy. It's not open-ended in as much as you know that she's not ending up with either of them. Again, sorry for spoilers, and at the time I was like, well, that's disappointing because my expectations were that there were these two eligible men, she'd pick one, happy wedding, the end. Whereas rereading it and now, I find it much more satisfactory. I still find it a little unresolved, but I find it much more satisfactorily unresolved because it you know, she's on the cusp of adulthood. Her life is very unlikely at that age to be like find the perfect person forever, particularly in the strange circumstances that the possible people have presented themselves. So I think the brilliance of that ending now, I think, is in its sense that nobody has resolution at the age of 17 or whatever she is at the end.
Yes.
And nor should she. Whereas when I was about her age, when as people say, you know, you think you know everything, etc., think, well, she's ready to start her, or to conclude her quest for love at whatever age. So I guess it depends. Yeah, that's a case of expectations not being met, and maybe I was the one who was unsatisfactory in that equation to start off with.
Yeah, I think it's interesting as well what you say there about how an ending can feel unresolved when you read it at a particular point in life, but when you read it again, you can perhaps have a better understanding of why the author might have wanted to leave it like that.
Mm.
And that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that with I Captured the Castle. I've just given it to one of my 14-year-old students to read over the holidays, and I'm very excited to see what she makes of it.
Mm. One that is literally unresolved, and this I was very frustrated with, was when I'd slogged through Wives and Daughters, and that was hundreds and hundreds of pages, and discovered she died before she finished it. So that's not even a finished novel, and she had left a plan for what was going to happen, so you do know what's going to happen. But I've loved other Elizabeth Gaskell. That one at the time, which was, you know, I was 18, didn't love that one as much, and I was quite cross that I'd spent all those hours and hours and hours on it and it was not finished. But we can hardly blame her for dying, I suppose. That was unjust of me.
No, I mean, I don't think she probably wanted to.
No.
I mean, for me, I think that sort of unfinished isn't necessarily unresolved, I suppose, in the sense of it being intentional.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's most recently one of my big discoveries of last year, as you know, was Claire Keegan. And I love the fact that Small Things Like These has an unresolved ending. Mm-hmm. So we get to the point where he's made this big decision, and I mean, I'll keep it vague as I can. And we get to the end of the book and the decision has been made, but we don't know what the reaction to that decision is going to be. And I absolutely love the fact that she ends it there, because there's so much work then that the reader has to do in thinking about an afterlife for these people and the story, and you can take it wherever you like in your imagination. And I think when you've got a novella and you have got that brevity of a story, and you don't have the same perhaps expectation that it's all going to be neatly tied up, because you've only got 100 pages, so how neat and tied be, there's more experimental scope on the behalf of the author to be able to test the reader with that sort of an ending, and to say, well, it's up to you, you know, you can decide. Or and I just taught it to my sixth formers, and they loved it, and we had lots of really interesting discussions about the ending and thinking about why she chose to end it where she did. And I thought, actually, this has been a much more satisfactory reading and teaching experience through having that uncertainty at the end than it would have been had there been a definitive a kind of moment at the end where we saw what the result was. So that for me was a really successful unresolved ending, and one that I actually think it would have been a worse book if she had tried to tie it up.
Yeah, and actually I can think of others like that where it's about the reliability of the narrator, I guess. So I won't say which one it is because it would be spoilers in a way, but one of the British Library Women Writers books, you end the novel not knowing if the main character is mad or not. And it doesn't necessarily affect everything that's come beforehand, but it does question a lot of, you know, a lot of things will be different, and it doesn't tell you one way or the other. You sort of end being, okay, she might have been tipped over the edge now. Possibly the greatest ambiguous ending is was this too many again, skip forward if you don't want spoilers for Daphne du Maurier's My Cousin Rachel. Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's the best for where I won't go into all the details of the plot, but basically there's a sort of you're left not knowing whether or not something happened, and both options are equally plausible, and you can convince yourself of either of them in turn, which is the whole point of the book, really. But I think she does it with the best balance between those two, because sometimes there's a sort of irresolution where you think, well, it has not been resolved, but it was probably X, Y, Z, or the narrative that comes before it would make more sense if it was this one of the two options. But I think that's the perfect one for really could go either way.
Yeah, and that is such a genius ending. I think I've read that book about 4 or 5 times, and each time I can't make my mind up. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the great flaw, actually, of the recent film they made, because they made it very clear what the interpretation was. And I was like, yeah, but that's not the point of the book. And I love that story so much, and I actually prefer it to Rebecca, because you've got which, and Rebecca's sort of got an unresolved ending as well, really, hasn't it?
That's true. It's got quite a weird ending and quite a weird beginning, actually. It's like, you know, people forget. I mean, everyone remembers the opening line, which I think is such a weird opening to have as well. But yeah, it does sort of stutter into life and then sort of peter out in a way. But
yeah, it's interesting. But I mean, My Cousin Rachel, I think, is so compelling a novel, because you do have that need to know. And I think it's one of those books where often you'll want to turn back to the beginning again and think, right, okay, well, obviously I must have missed something, and you want to go back and start again. And that trick for the reader is really clever. This just makes me want to read it again, actually. But I remember, talking about sort of resolved endings that are unsatisfactory, and so for me felt unresolved. I have to be very careful here, because the ending is the whole point. But I'm thinking about The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie. And the first, I mean, it just absolutely, I'm useless at figuring out who the murderer is in crime. I mean, I'm like the perfect reader for these, because oh my goodness, at the end, the kind of ending is amazing, you know, and you do think like, wow, that's so clever. But I thought, there's no way, even when I read it again straight afterwards, I couldn't see the clues clearly enough. So for me, I felt like it came out of nowhere. So, and I didn't really believe in the justification for it. So for me, it was kind of unresolved in that sense, because I was like, I don't feel satisfied, because I haven't, number one, I haven't been able to, I haven't been given the ability to work out the ending myself, and secondly, I don't buy it. I still love it as a book.
That's interesting, because I mean, I I just believe anything I'm told, so I'm like, sure, yeah, you got me. But I do. It's interesting, yeah, because I guess we've got these parallel things we're talking about, where resolution is a plot device or element of the plot, but there's the emotional resolution in the reader, and they can cohere or not. I was thinking of the sort of writers where the plot and resolution idea just doesn't. It's sort of meaningless because the books they do are either so abstract or so incidental that you're never going to have that sort of thing. And I was thinking Milan Kundera, for example, where I think his novel Identity, which is, you know, starts with looking at someone, not identity, immortality, starts with someone swimming and then goes off on this reverie about the curve of the arm, like the movement and all these sorts of things. And that leads to one idea to another, and it goes all over history and famous people and different characters. But there's no sense in which that could resolve. And a large part of it is intending to convey the complexity and breadth of life, which is, you know, how could anyone resolve that? So I think there's some authors, and it doesn't have to be that broad. It could just be, here's a slice of life, a bit like Perfection. We won't go say too much about Perfection now, but it could just be, here is this person or these people over a day, a week, a year of their life. And like everyone, you know, you don't get resolution at the end of any period until you die, and even then maybe not. But so that sort of writer, maybe more often in literary fiction than genre fiction, I guess, you might get that sort of emotional resolution in reading it, where you think, yes, that ends in the right place, but you're never going to get a narrative resolution of tying up the ends neatly with a bow on it.
No, and I think those are the best sorts of novels, really. Ones where nothing happens, but everything happens at the same time. I think for me, I've got a couple of things to talk about. So the first thing I'll say is Atonement by Ian McEwan is an interesting one. I've just been teaching this as well. It's always books I'm teaching that I actually properly dig into, you know. And we've got ourselves tied into such knots with it. It was like going into the Matrix and looking at the fact that actually when you get to the end, you realise that everything you've read before didn't actually happen. And that the book, it's most of the book itself could just be like the premise of the book could not be true. And so you get to the end of the book and you realize, think to yourself, well, what was the point of that? Because I'm not sure whether any of this even happened within the world of the book, and whether I've just been taken for a ride for the last, you know, 400 pages. And that kind of experiment, I think, I mean, for me it works really well. I really enjoy it. I mean, I don't love Ian McEwan as a writer, as you well know, but I do like Atonement because I think it is a lovely literary trick on the reader. But my students really struggled with that lack of resolution at the end of knowing what they were supposed to take from it. They didn't understand, you know, is this so, is part one and part two really happened but part three and four didn't, or did any of part one really happen, or did this happen and that happen? And not having that ability to fall back on a narrative that made sense and that had that sense of clarity in terms of, well, the character did this and then this happened and then that was the result, didn't work for them. And I thought, that's interesting. But I like that. I don't have an issue with that sort of ending, because for me the resolution is in the kind of the working out, the kind of the message of the text, and I'm happy to make my mind up about that. But the only thing that really pisses me off with a book is when it deliberately ends unresolved because there's going to be another book coming.
Oh yes, yeah.
I hate that. It's so annoying. It's like, look, I'm not being funny, but I've just read 300 pages of this book. I've got to wait 3 years for you to write the next one. Like, come on. I just think that's mean. If even when you're planning on writing a sequel, I think that there needs to be some kind of resolution. You can't leave it where it's like, and she opened the door, and, you know, so and so wasn't there or whatever. It's like, oh, come on. That frustrates me. And I think that's less of a trend now, but certainly a couple of years ago, when everybody was being pressured into writing these kind of seven longs, it was a bit like, there's no point starting this until all of them are finished, because otherwise I'm just going to be annoyed.
Yeah, and like traditionally, that even books like the Foresight Saga or, you know, the Capulet Chronicles or things where they are deliberately continuing, you would not get that. You'd still, this, you know, this book could be read independently and it would be satisfying in both emotionally and in terms of plot conclusions, and you just pick up with them later, and it's less of, yeah, sort of, I think you're right, there's sort of cheap marketing ploy of, you better get the next one, is maybe people have cottoned onto it.
Well, it's all very well to get the next one if it's actually been published.
Yes. Yes, if they get axed midway, then it's, more annoying.
Sometimes that does happen as well. Then people don't get a book deal for the next one.
Yeah.
The first one doesn't sell very well, and you've just got this standalone book that nobody knows what actually happened.
Do you have anything more to add, or should we go to our decision making?
Let's go to our decision making.
I do love the sort of slice of life where there is no resolution because there's never intended to be. But I think there's something so deeply satisfying about getting to the end, finding out, yes, that murderer did it, or yep, they are getting married, and it's, you know, there's that dopamine hit of it all resolved, either in a surprising or satisfying or both way. So I'm going to go with resolved endings.
Yeah, I think, you know, ultimately, it's always nice to have it rounded off. I mean, when we think about reasons why we read because we want to be comforted from the horrors of our world, as most of the time, and finishing up being like, well, I don't know what I was supposed to take from that. It's not helping me. So, yes, I would always take a resolved ending over an unresolved one.
There we go. Thank you, Lindsay, so much for that question.
Yeah.
It was a fun one. And again, I think I might go back and add a note saying that we did say more spoilers than we intended. So apologies if we've ruined any book you were thinking of reading, but at least you know whether or not you'll get resolution.
Yeah.
We do have a question from the middle.
Oh.
From David, actually sent this one in a while ago, which is, you know, he sent in a few funny ones, but I like this one. Can buying a book in a supermarket ever end well?
That's a good one. A cookbook, maybe.
Oh, that's a good, yeah, good shout.
Yeah.
On the Rest is Entertainment podcast, which is Rich Dosman, who obviously massive selling detective author now, and Marina Hyde, he's always desperate never to offend anyone. He does talk about the canny people buying books for supermarkets. I would personally say you could find some good books there, because they do sometimes have some actual literature there as well as trash, but you should never buy a book in a bookshop, sorry, in a supermarket, because you should be buying them from a bookshop, preferably an independent one, because that supermarket is not going to pay the publisher very much for that. They'll be buying them massive bulk, a huge discount. The author will get probably almost nothing, and you will not be keeping bookshops alive on the high street. So I don't think I would ever buy a book in a supermarket myself, but it's not for the quality of the books in there necessarily.
No, I think that's a very good point. I mean, I dislike that sort of bulk buying thing. But at the same time, I think there are a lot of busy and harassed people out there who, if they only manage to get to the shops once a week and it's just whizzing around the supermarket and they can grab a book while they're out, then I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
That is a good point. And also, like, if your budget for books is like, you know, £2 a month or something, and we've all been there, it's like, cool, yeah. No judgment for you, but if you can afford to buy it in a bookshop and you've got the time to do that, then do. Yeah, I'd say do that.
The bookshop. But I do think it's a shame that supermarkets seem to assume that most people just want to read essentially chick lit or books about people getting murdered and police solving it.
There's so many children being kidnapped. My goodness. Yeah.
It's just a very limited range, and I think, is this what most people read? Maybe it is. Maybe I just don't mix with most people. I don't know, but
And the one I was surprised, it's not a supermarket, but FOP. I don't even know if FOP still exists, but in the UK at least it might be broader. It was mostly like DVD, CD, that sort
Never
of thing
heard company.
Well, it is a chain, but maybe it's only in some places. Actually, no, there used to be one in Seven Dials, I think. Anyway, they also had a book section, and it was weirdly like high quality literature, the sort of place that you wouldn't necessarily expect to have those sorts of, you know, the things that people are looking for. I think because it was largely their main thing was like DVDs, it was lots of books that have been turned into films. So, you know, that tends to include lots of classics, etc. But then also they'd have quite a lot of highbrow, but, you know, intelligent nonfiction in the sort of place where you might expect it just to be trashy, schlocky literature. So if FOP still exists, again, I should probably go to a real bookshop, but you'll find some good quality literature on their shelves. But again, they may have gone to the wall, so don't worry too much about about FOP with two P's, just in case people are googling it.
I mean, I don't think I've ever seen it, so I think probably it's gone.
Probably gone. The one in Oxford's certainly gone a long time ago, but it was not here for very long.
I'm sorry to tell you that.
Yeah, R.O.P. FOP. But thank you, David. Very, very fun question. From your phrasing, I suspect your answer would be it could not end well, and that's certainly the side I would land on. Or rather, I would encourage people, if they can, not to buy their books in supermarkets.
Yes. Okay. Well, that was a fun question. But they do sell very good cookbooks, I will say that.
Yeah, I suppose it's the right place for. You can buy one and then go around and buy all the ingredients you need.
Well, that's it. It's very convenient.
Yeah.
Yeah, we
are. I tend to get recipe books as or cookbooks as presents. I don't think I've ever bought one for myself, but I do like them. They make a good present.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
Great. So, yeah, as Rachel sort of said at the beginning, in the last episode, we each picked a book that we thought the other one would like. I picked a book that turns out Rachel had already given up on in the past. So we switched to Catherine Carter by Pamela Hansford Johnson. And she picked for me Perfection by Vincenzo Lettronico. Is that what you landed on?
Well, I mean, we Lettronico. Don't mix. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, translated by Sophie Hughes. Shall we introduce the ones that we've just read rather than the ones we chose, maybe?
Yes.
Great. Well, let's go chronological.
Okay, so Catherine Carter is about a woman called Catherine Carter, funnily enough. and it's set in the 1880s in London in the world of the theatre. That's why Simon thought it would be appropriate for me. And it's Catherine is, as a young girl, given the opportunity to become part of the acting company of Henry Peverell, who is a kind of loosely based Henry Irving, I should think. He was a big theatre owner, actor, manager in the London theatre scene in the Victorian period. And this is a huge honour for her. And she becomes part of his company, and he sort of trains her, and she's got this sort of talent that everyone else can see, but he doesn't seem to see it yet. And she's very highly strung and very emotional, and she knows that she has greatness, and she wants to be given the opportunity, but he keeps casting her in really small roles, and her mother's really annoying and keeps embarrassing her and trying to push her to do things. And you see that sort of Catherine's desire to do things. Then we also see Henry and what he wants to do, and no great surprise to say that they do fall in love, but it's a long time coming, and there are also lots of complications along the way. So that's Catherine Carter. You also get lots of descriptions of plays and rehearsals and things, which I found most amusing.
Great, yeah. And so Perfection, it was published, I think, 2022, but just been translated into English maybe this year or late last year. Mm-hmm. It has been nominated for the International Booker Prize. Yeah. And it is set in Berlin. There's a couple called Tom and Anna who have moved there from another country. We're never told which one it is, but it's somewhere else in Europe, one assumes, not an English-speaking place. And they, it follows them over the course of a decade or so, I guess, in not many pages, living as young professionals, working in websites, I guess, and graphic design and sort of things I don't understand. And their evolution of what it's like to be in your early to mid-20s with lots of friends in and out of each other's lives, always going to parties, etc. And then as you get older and your friends start moving away or having babies or what sort of thing, what your life looks like then. The unusual thing about the book is that there is absolutely no dialogue in it at all, not a line of dialogue in it. And I've never read anything that took that approach. So yeah, it's a short book, and it's really, I guess, we don't learn very much about Tom and Anna as individuals. It's really a sort of state of the nation or state of a generation sort of novella, I would say.
Yeah.
Yes. And I was trying to think what these books have in common, and I got down to young people entering creative fields. So that is their commonality.
Well, there we are. You can always find a connection. I love it.
And they do both, I guess, look at what it is like to enter a job which it feels like a vocation, or like, yeah, something you're called to it by your inherent creativity, and then how to find your expression within that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you could hardly find two more different novels along those lines.
No, you couldn't. Okay, I'm nervous, so you start the discussion.
Because we have not told each other whether or not we like these books.
We haven't.
I'm going to put you out of your misery. I think Perfection is absolutely brilliant. I loved it. So yes, I was nervous when I started because dialogue is often what I'm drawn to in a novel. And I didn't realize there wasn't going to be any dialogue until I just kept turning pages and be like, oh, we still haven't got any. And indeed, the opening scene was quite hard for me because it's describing the layout of this flat in Berlin. As it looks in photographs on an estate agent website, and then versus what it looks like in reality. And as we've talked about many times on here, I cannot visualize things. I fall apart if I'm expected to remember where things are in relation to each other in a room or in a building. So I was totally at sea for that. I couldn't picture it, but I could sort of get the vibes nonetheless. And then, yeah, it's basically, I think it's my life is not very like Tom or Anna's, and never was. I think it's the first time we've done a novel on Teal Books that has lengthy discussions of sex toys, but it is, I've never been clubbing, I've never done drugs, all these things that they're doing, but it still felt really vividly like a description of what it's like to be a millennial and the experience of going from your 20s to their sort of late 30s by the end. I'm late 30s now. And even though my life experience is very different from theirs, and I've never been to Berlin and all these things, it was amazingly, it felt like it was speaking for our generation in a way that I don't think I've read anything else that does in the same way.
Oh, well, I'm delighted because I felt exactly the same way about it. I felt that it really summed up what it feels like to live in our contemporary world, to be our age. I mean, obviously, I don't work. Neither of us work in that kind of peripatetic online way where you that life of working in cafes on laptops. But certainly walking around London, it seems that this huge numbers of people do very much live that way. And this very disconnected life where everything is kind of, I suppose, yeah, lived online and lived very what's the word I'm looking for, peripatetically, you know, like people moving on the whole time. And I think when you live in a big city like I do, you know, that does very much become your life. And I also have worked in international schools for a decade, so I'm used to friends coming and going and people coming here for things and going away again, and the transient nature of people's lives. And it's that reality of how things just slowly change, and then one day you wake up and you realize I haven't really got any friends anymore. Where's everybody gone? And that moment in your kind of late 30s where it's like, but my lifestyle hasn't changed and I've been doing the same things, and everybody else around me seems to be changing and shifting. And I found it really poignant and also really powerful in looking at how shallow actually many people of a certain background, obviously, I mean, we're talking about middle class people here, let's face it, actually are. And from the outside, everything looks very successful and very happy. And certainly where I live, if you walk around at the weekend, you know, everyone my age is out and about getting their coffees and buying their stuff from the farmer's market and whatever. But it's like, this book really explores the idea of how empty after a while that is, and it's a kind of replacement for deeper meaning and deeper connection. And I just, yeah, I think that's it gave me so much to think about.
Yeah, but I also think it's too clever a book to be like too on the nose with that message, because well, at least I did get the mix of sadness and continuing joy. Like, it wasn't a sort of this is a superficial life that will end up being miserable sort of novel or anything like that. It was yeah, so much cleverer than that. And I thought, I mean, I read a review earlier today that said it was a satire of a certain lifestyle. And I really don't think it is a satire. I think it is just an exploration of a certain type of life in a, yeah, as you say, a certain class. And although, you know, Oxford is the city I lived in for a long time. I guess I'm one of the people who left now, but much smaller than London. But people often said, my church often said, in fact, that a quarter of Oxford leave every year. So it is that very transient, very, you know, constant turnover. I always having friends move to London or move to other places. And, or, you know, even if they're staying there, if they get married and have kids, then their life is suddenly very different from mine. And it really captures that in a way that is, as I said in the intro, Tom and Anna are not memorable characters. I don't know anything about Tom and Anna, really. They don't differ from each other in any way. There's no, like, Tom thinks this, but Anna prefers this. They have a couple fights, but it could have, you know, didn't matter who said what, really. They're very deliberately negligible as characters because they are just there to represent a generation.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that that choice is made, and that can feel very alienating when you're reading a book. It's our desire to want to connect to characters and to feel absorbed. There's a deliberate distance kept there, but I think actually that makes it more effective because it makes it more possible for you to engage with it as a commentary on the lives that we live, and for you to, I suppose, see yourself reflected in it.
So we have a short novel that covers quite a lot of time about characters you don't know very well, and then a very long novel that very gradually, slowly reveals these characters over a shorter period of time, or still quite a long period of time. What did you think of Catherine Carter?
Well, I absolutely loved it.
Hooray! Gosh, what a successful episode for us.
Brilliant. I mean, I was thinking to myself when I was finishing it last night, it's been a long time since I've had a book like this where I've genuinely looked forward to getting home or going to bed so I can pick it up and get back into the world. And it's one of those books that's got such compelling characters, and it's a little bit dramatic, melodramatic, but in an enjoyable way. And I what I really love about it is both of those things, but it's also incredibly well written. So you don't feel like you're reading something trashy. It's not a beach read by any means. And I was actually interested, I'm sure that you must have read other books by her, as I haven't, so I'd be really interested in reading other things by her. But it's very well researched. The detail of life in the theatre in the 19th century is really well realized. I mean, it's, she was in the theatre world as well, Pamela Hansford Johnson, and you can tell. And so the attention to detail on things like, you know, what was it like backstage? What would a rehearsal look like? What would this person's job have been? You know, what kind of clothes would have been worn? That kind of thing. It does feel very authentic. And the prose itself also has a kind of 19th century air to it as well. So I've just absolutely loved it. And to be honest, I was really sad to finish because I could have, even at the length it is, I could have read more. I'm delighted to come, and I would never in a million years have come across it if you hadn't recommended it, so I'm very grateful.
And I love the photo you sent of the cover, which made it look so trashy on your edition. I'm so glad you loved it, because I think you're right, I found it a page turner, even though it really isn't, not the some plot, but it's really just the way she realizes characters. It made me just want to spend more time with them. And that's, it's so different from Perfection, where, as you say, those characters are so anonymous, really. Whereas this one, I felt that she had a real fondness and love for her characters that you don't often get. It reminded me of Elizabeth Gooch, actually, for that. She just really knows and loves her characters, even when they're, you know, they're not paragons of virtue by any means. I get similarly, I don't often love long books, but I just want to spend as much time as I could with them. I was always looking forward to picking it up. And I think what both of these books do in quite different ways is really realise a world. So the characters matter much more in Catherine Carter, but the world of the theatre is still the main thing, I think. You're so immersed in an author who loves theatre and characters who love theatre. Because even when they're arguing, or when Henry is being pompous, or Catherine's doubting herself, that what unites the characters is how much they respect and revere the stage, and that comes across to the reader. So I think I really loved about it actually is, and this was so indulgent, but it worked, the really lengthy explorations of how to stage different Shakespeare plays and how to perform the characters and how to get to the depth of the lines, and often quoting at length from the plays, thinking, I don't think a publisher would let you do that now, but it was so wonderful to spend that time. Yeah,
it is. I think it's lovely to have novels like this where the world is so well built, and you know, maybe not a lot is actually happening, but you're just spending time with these people who become so well fleshed out and so real to you that you really do care about them, and you want them to get what they want. And it's just that really comforting experience of falling back into that world again every time you open it up and be like, oh, I wonder what they're going to get up to today, or I wonder how the play is going to be received. Oh my god, nobody likes this. They like this, getting swept up in the drama of it. And I think it's just so enjoyable, and a real mark of a really gifted writer in being able to compel you as a reader and to draw and to build a world that feels so realistic and three-dimensional. So it's a real discovery, I would say. And Simon, I would love to hear about any other books that she's written.
Sure. So, I mean, she wrote a lot. I've read three of her other novels. I've read The Honours Board, which is set in a school, actually, a boarding school. An Error of Judgment, which is about someone being brutally attacked and then a sort of court case after that. And The Unbearable Skipton. Unspeakable Skipton. It's The Unbearable Bassington by Saki, isn't it? Yes, The Unspeakable Skipton. And I don't really remember anything about that. And I really liked The Honours Board. I really didn't like An Error of Judgment. I was sort of on the fence with The Unspeakable Skipton. But I think what really surprised me about Catherine Carter is how different it is from those other books, and I think much better than those other books, or at least much more to my taste, because she seems quite detached from her characters in the other ones, and is that sort of more like she's presenting them like a puppeteer sort of thing, as opposed to really loving them. That's why I mentioned it, because it really stood out to me how much she cares about her characters, and I don't think she really does in those other ones I read. So I think you might enjoy The Honours Board, particularly for the school setting. I wouldn't necessarily recommend the other two, but there are an awful lot more. And somebody, I forget which publisher was reprinting some of them maybe like 5, 6, 7 years ago. So I've got An Impossible Marriage that whoever that was reprinted. And I think she did do some maybe a trilogy or something as well. This is really stand out for me. And if I'd read this one first and then the others, I think I'd have been quite disappointed by the other ones because they're so different. But if other people have read a lot and can recommend one more like this one, I'd definitely be keen to read more of her, because it was such a revelation to me.
I mean, what a treat. I don't think I've found anything else by this author, Vincenzo Latronico. Someone Italian, please tell us how to say this.
Yes, the note in the front says that this is the only one that's been translated to English so far.
Yes, it's Sophie Hughes, you need to get on the case and translate.
And he's a translator himself, apparently, but from English into Italian rather than the other way around. Something I continue back with Carter. I loved her mom. I thought she was a brilliant creation. So she's basically a stage mom, but she's very pushy, but she's the funniest character, I think, and she's got this amazing ability to turn anything into a glowing compliment. She sees what she wants to see. So you know, someone will mention Catherine in passing in a review, and she manages to twist that in her mind until it's Catherine's the star of the show.
Yes.
I loved it. She reminded me actually a bit of Pam from Gavin and Stacey. Just not a comparison necessarily. It's a leap to everyone's mind. But,
No, that's a good comparison. I loved her in the sense that, you know, she's so willing to be offended by anything seems to be exciting her daughter, and she's so worried about everything, and particularly at the beginning where she, you know, she's so naughty and mischievous in the things that she does to kind of, well, you know, I've just gone to see him and I've told him this. And like, oh my God, no. But she's very well meaning. I also love that she's like, I'm so old at the beginning. It's like, you're 42, baby.
Yeah.
it's really, it's got those moments of real comedy, real enjoyable comedy. But there's also moments of real sort of emotional drama and things. So it's certainly a page turner. So a very different reading experience to Perfection in many ways. But at the same time, I found Perfection very addictive and I couldn't put it down. I think I read it in sort of two sittings, actually.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And I think it's a very engaging novel that explores so much in such a brilliant way. And I'm always incredibly admiring of people who can write books that are so short but that say so much. And I think he's really one to watch.
Yeah, and I think it had to be short for that sort of absence of dialogue and absence of delineated character, because I think that would, I think it worked brilliantly here, but I think it would have really worn it over a 300, 400 page novel. Because I don't know if this was his thought, but it feels to me like he said, can you write a novel that doesn't have any characters in, essentially? And I think the answer is yes, it turns out you can, but not at, not a, you know, magnum opus, maybe. What was I going to say? Oh, yes, well, thinking of, I was thinking about the romance in Catherine Carter, and then we could maybe the comparable non-romance or romance in Perfection. Because I started Catherine Carter thinking, please do not get together. But I could see, like, it's obviously going to happen, but she's 18, he's, I think, 36, although he often seems much older than that in the way he's behaving. And yet when it happens, you've sort of, it's far, as you said, it's far enough into the novel that I think it was okay that she was a bit older, you got to know them better. It didn't feel like the same power imbalance that I worried it was at the outset. Whereas I think Tom and Anna are interesting in that it talks a bit about, you know, when their sex is good or sex is bad. It talks about when they get on or don't get on. I'd got a sense, again, because we don't know much about them, about love or romance between them. Or the romance, I guess, was told through objects, the furniture they buy together, or the websites they look at together, or the way they message each other. We don't see the words, but just describing how they're in touch with each other, which I thought, it was interesting that you get a sense of the dynamic between them just through the objects that they own, rather than the words or they use to communicate, or even the emotions they express, which I think worked. I still got a sense of what sort of relationship it was, but I'd be hard placed to know how I'd come to that conclusion. What did you think?
Yeah, I think the same. I mean, it's they have this very interconnected, completely shared life where they've got the same tastes and everything, and they even do the same job, don't they? So It's they kind of emerged into one being. So when they do disagree over something, which is quite rare, then it's it feels a bit odd, because it's like, well, you kind of seem like this one homogenous being, really, and they're quite dependent on each other. They don't really seem to have much of an independent life desires. Like, you never really see
no separate friendships or anything.
No separate friendships, nothing. Like, they seem to exist in this little silo, which I found quite interesting. And yeah, like the objects that they choose together, or the things that they choose to do at the weekend, are the way in which they express their personalities, I suppose, and the way that they express who they are as a couple. And I think actually they don't really have individual identities outside of each other, and that's quite interesting as well. It's like they come as a package, and I wonder whether that's part of what the novel's message is saying as well, this idea that the world is built around, you know, you have to have a relationship, you have to be in a couple, and you move into these places together, and how you define yourselves to the world is through what you own and through what you make your house look like and so on and so forth. And that lack of interest in them as individuals, and also that lack of interest in how their relationship works, is another commentary on shallowness, I suppose. I don't know. I mean, that's how I read it.
Do you know Berlin well? Have you been much at all?
I'm about to go. But no, I've never been. So I was interested.
You'll be able to report back soon, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it makes it sound great.
Yeah, because I think the only things I really know about Berlin come from Christopher Isherwood novels, and I assume things have changed slightly since his Berlin novels. But I guess, as you say, in some ways it could be any big, or even not that big city. I think it's any city where you can live that sort of life. Because as I say, like, it made me think of Oxford a lot, even though Oxford is, I assume, very different from Berlin. But just living as a young person in a city away from your family, away from, I guess at the stage of your life where your friends are your family, as someone once said about the sitcom Friends.
And it's, I think as well, it's that even though it's set in Berlin, it could be anywhere. I think that's also part of the success of the book. But I think there's something that's quite interesting about this commentary of European life and how for so many young Europeans, moving to another country is so normal and so usual, and moving around and going, oh, I'm going to spend a year living in this country, then living in that country, and kind of engaging with those foreign countries on a very surface level. Like the fact, I found it really interesting that all of the characters in the book, even though none of them are English, native English speakers, their shared language is English because none of them have bothered to learn German. And none of them know each other's languages. So they're living in this kind of fake world, even within that country. I mean, Anna and Tom have been there for 10 years and they still barely speak enough German to get by. And they're considered really good at German by other people who've just arrived. And I found that really interesting as well, that sense of this nomadic life. I mean, what are these people, digital nomads, aren't they? And this idea of how easy it is to move around and exist in other places, but if you never are able to really become like a local, then what is the purpose of living in that place?
I did wonder if digital nomads translated into something that was a more common expression in Italian, because that felt slightly awkward to me. Mm-hmm. And there are a few moments actually where the translation, I mean, I don't speak Italian, but where there are words where I thought, well, that doesn't quite fit. Like, I remember quite early on it talks about them tidying up and it says that they shoved something in the dishwasher, which is, you know, a common expression, but really didn't feel like the way the rest of the paragraph was written, and things like that was like, oh, that's slightly odd. I mean, I'm sure, I mean, I don't know what the original said. But those are only tiny moments in what otherwise felt like a very immersive, I guess quite sparse, prose. But I just wanted to read one line that maybe you reminded me of in what you were saying, but also pinpoints this is a novel that really is specifically about one time of life and one period in history. Here's the quote: "They will be tempted to search elsewhere for what they found all those years ago in Berlin, and then tried and failed to find again that winter, but it will prove impossible because that abundance was the result of a specific overlay between the city's history and theirs." And I thought that was great. Mm. Because, I mean, it's to do with house prices and job availability and all that sort of thing. And there are very specific references to cultural moments. Most movingly, the little boy who was a Syrian refugee who was found drowned on a beach and the impact that had. So these things are very clearly dated. And I guess, you know, as you said, Catherine Carter is very much in the 1880s theatre. So they're very much novels of a specific moment. You couldn't transfer what's happening to these characters to any other decade or any other way. As we say, one didn't have to be Berlin necessarily. The other one, Catherine Carter, I think, would have to be London. But and I'm glad to hear what you say about Catherine Carter being accurate, because I don't know anything really about 1880s theatre. I'm much more comfortable in sort of 1920s or 30s theatre, so I didn't know how accurate it was, but I'm glad that it was to your mind.
I was very happy with it, so
because she doesn't like make the dialogue feel necessarily sort of, I think it's probably not the most authentic dialogue for 1880s. I don't know, maybe it is, but it didn't feel like historical fiction in the way that, you know, some people are very clearly putting on the guise of the past. They felt very vibrant characters, dialogue could have existed in the 1930s potentially as well as the 1880s.
For me it just felt very natural, and these people felt like, you know, I think actually that's the reality. I mean, you know, we think about, oh, well, everybody spoke differently, but they didn't. It's just 19th century novels have got very...
That's true. It's a good point. Yeah.
So just like when you look at a photograph of people from the 19th century, if you took off the silly hair and the silly clothes, they have faces just like ours.
Made them in colour,
Well, first for both of them.
Yeah, I'm really pleased with that, because often when we pick books, we think the other one will like, it has not worked. But we finally nailed it.
I'm delighted. I was worried. I thought, oh gosh, maybe it will be too much for him. But no, good.
Right, well, decision-making time. Which one are you going to choose?
Oh, that's really hard, because they're both really good in a very different way. In terms of which one would I read again, I'm going to say two things. So, would I read again? And possibly when ill, Catherine Carter, wonderful.
Nice.
But the book that I feel like spoke to me and that I would read again because of that is perfection. So I mean, I love them both. I like them both equally for different reasons. So that's what I'm saying.
Okay, but you have to pick one. That's the whole point of the podcast.
Oh, probably perfection then.
Okay. Similarly, I'm finding this a really hard decision. I've gone back and forth in my mind all day because I think they probably will both end up in my top books of the year at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just loved spending time with Catherine Carton. It was just a real comfort read. But I think because it's doing something so different and doing it so successfully, I am going to lean towards perfection as well. So there you go. Yeah, but who knows? But when my books of the year come out, they may reverse the position. You never know. But for today, I'm saying perfection.
Okay, well, I will take that.
Yeah, thank you so much for recommending it, because again, I would never have picked this up. I love Fitzcarraldo, but I've only read their nonfiction. I've not read any of their fiction.
Well, likewise, we've both done each other a favour. Look,
hurrah! And if you've been reading along, or indeed if you read Jest of God because you thought we were doing that, I hope you've enjoyed that. In the next episode, we will be doing The Beautiful Visit by Elizabeth Jane Howard and The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearne by Brian Moore. You can find all the books and authors we mentioned at my blog, stuckinabook.com, and you can find Rachel at bookstob.substack.com. And we look forward to talking to you next time. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, guys. Bye.
Bye.